Fear and Loathing in the Wasteland, The Happy Bureaucracy, Book 2, by M.P. Fitzgerald, narrated by Gary Bennett. Author's note. Strewn between drug use, groin malice, and cursing on a level tantamount to sacrilege are even more gratuitous mentions of bureaucracy. These bureaucratic references may not be for the weak of heart. Also, child endangerment. Did I mention child endangerment? Chapter 13. When Arthur opened his eyes that morning, he feared the worst. When the worst did not immediately come, and instead was tempered down by a few levels, he erroneously let his dread pass. The worst, of course, was only waiting for the right moment. The worst is a total prima donna like that. He had disobeyed orders, had been out of line with the highest-ranking official of the IRS, as well as the battlefield, and he had created a bureaucratic clusterfuck that prevented said official to run the war or to give orders. The surprising part of it? Arthur regretted none of it. These were not the actions of the IRS poster boy he had once been. No, these were the actions of a rebel and of a man who made ethical decisions. Neither of those things were traits for the modern-day bureaucrat. Or, well, any bureaucrat of any age, honestly. He was preparing himself for the worst. He knew that Boyd wanted him dead. Banishment did not sound out of order, and at the very least, a demotion would be on the list. Whatever his punishment for disobeying Boyd and mucking up the system was, he knew that it was going to be horrible. Richard and Ralph had left the tent to fill their coffee rations and to stretch their legs before the inevitable hell of battle raged on. The slavers had stayed put, never daring to leave the confines of their walls. They were far more disciplined than Arthur had suspected they would be. He figured that, at the very least, they would try to surprise attack them in the night. But the slavers acted as if it were a long game. They only had to protect their walls and to wait out the IRS's rations. What happened if the colonel returned? There was no pleasantry. There was no announcement. An enforcer simply walked through the tent's entrance and stated his case. "Boyd wants to see you," he said, clutching a shotgun. Arthur knew better than to protest. It was off hours, sure, but Arthur had a feeling that this particular enforcer intended to use his shotgun as soon as possible. Arthur was coming, dead or alive. The enforcer led Arthur to the control van in silence. This was perfectly fine with Arthur. Awkward conversation with a man that could kill you was not exactly the kind of thing that he looked forward to. The seat on top of the van was still empty, and the lazy morning light glistened off the layer of dew condensed on the van's walls. The enforcer knocked at the van's back door.
"Just a boy," Boyd said from the other side.
The enforcer opened the door for Arthur, stepped aside, and closed the door behind Arthur as he entered. Boyd was seated, a clipboard in his hand, and his coffee thermos in the other. He held the board outstretched to Arthur tentatively. He did not speak until the footsteps of the enforcer had faded.
"Sign this."
Arthur took an awkward step forward. He had to bend forward because of the low ceiling and found that the rows of filing cabinets that had been cramped inside left just enough space for his hips, but not his elbows. Boyd watched Arthur's every agonized and awkward movement forward with no humor. Arthur took the clipboard and read the form attached. It was a simple write-up, a disciplinary form that stated that Arthur had done wrong, but with no further consequence except for maybe another write-up written in harsher language, should he do it again. That was it. No banishment, no demotion, just a figurative slap on the wrist. "Sir?" Arthur exclaimed, unable to hide his surprise and confusion.
"It's a write-up," Boyd responded as he calmly uncapped his thermos. "Sign it."
Arthur did, then he handed the form back. Boyd took out a stamp and set both the clipboard and the stamp on his lap.
"This is all that needs to happen," Boyd said, with a thermos cap in his hand. "And nothing more. But let us speak frankly."
Boyd took a long pull of coffee, then set it on an X marked off in tape on the floor.
"What do I need to give you in return for the exact order that you gave to the operations manager to halt my ability to command my men and women?"
If there were space,
and a way to do it without hurting his neck, Arthur would have taken a step back at this. Was the commissioner actually trying to bargain with him? Had Arthur, in his rash decision-making, gotten an upper hand on Boyd that was lasting? Arthur decided that the best possible thing to do in a position like this was to put on his best poker face and act coy. You think I did something to, halt your orders? Arthur said, as his eyebrows shifted to find a home on his forehead that was natural. They did not. Henry S. Boyd gave Arthur a hard blink, and his clasped hands became clenched. There is less than an hour before the work klaxon sounds. Cut the crap, Mr. McDowell, Boyd said with unblinking eyes. Let's get everything on the table. I could have you dead, have wanted you dead, if I was feeling nice, which I never do. I could have had you and your stupid enforcer friend banished. But if I did those things, I would still have an army that I cannot command, and the biggest tax audit in our post-nuclear history to run without the ability to file paperwork. You want something. I need something. What do you want? Boyd picked up his thermos and drank through clenched teeth. Nothing is off the table, Boyd continued. Promotion, pay raise, even your bleeding heart cause. You want something? We find out how best it works for both of us. And you tell me how to get back my army. He returned the thermos back onto its taped-off spot, then clasped his hands once more. What will it be? If Arthur had any idea just how badly he had cornered Boyd with his simple paper filing, he would have thought about this all night. Henry S. Boyd, the nefarious chess player from the shadows, was desperate. Arthur had all of the cards. It was time to act like it. You killed DeWitt, Arthur said, putting his answer off to Boyd's visible annoyance. Not literally, but you sent him, Robbie, and myself off to die. You sent out a man who delivered your coffee laid out to die. You sent innocent men and women to their deaths for a promotion. Arthur's voice was firm, but not sturdy. There was no position in the claustrophobic van that could make him look strong. But strong is exactly how he felt. Why in the hell should I trust that you'll hold your end of the bargain? DeWitt was hardly innocent, Mr. McDowell, Boyd replied, and I did not do it for a promotion. I did it for power. Real men don't kill for petty things like a position. They do it for the position's perks. Boyd straightened his tie to a single degree, then looked Arthur directly in the eyes. Name your terms, and I'll tell you exactly why you can trust me. Boyd had said that all the chips were on the table, yet Arthur did not expect him to admit to his web of deceit and lies so candidly, almost like he was bored. But Boyd did not blink. He offered no amends or excuses. Boyd had effectively taken out the air to any righteous anger and passionate speeches Arthur had planned on saying. Arthur's neck began to strain under the odd position. He crouched down on one knee, then found his height now even with Boyd. I want you to assure me that the slaves will make it out of here alive, Arthur said. Now, how can I trust you? You can't, Boyd answered, leaning closer. But you have no choice. Let's say you don't give me what I want, and that I don't figure out how to fix my little paper jam. The tax army leaves the slaves alive. But then what? We don't have to take them. I can still order Ralph and the rest of the auditors to possess the colonel's mutant car fleet instead, or find the amount of back taxes and bullets or real estate. Arthur could now feel the warm, almost damp breath of Boyd on his nose as the commissioner came closer. But I can't control the troops effectively. I can't order and react to any hidden aces the slavers might have up their sleeves. And at the end of the day, if you somehow make it out alive, I still have to worry about you complaining to human resources about DeWitt's death. Boyd inhaled deeply. Basically, if you don't trust me, and I don't get what I need, we are both fucked, Mr. McDowell. This is the only way the slaves survive. The Only one. Arthur knew he was about to make a Faustian deal with a man who would rather organize hell than serve in heaven. Arthur knew that it was a bad deal, but he also knew that Boyd was right. The only scenario Arthur could see where the slaves walked away from this like he had hoped was the deal. Assure me that the slaves will be freed from the slavers and that they will make it out of here alive, Arthur said. Then leave me and my enforcer Rabia alone. Do that, and I will fix the paper jam. Boyd leaned away from Arthur and settled naturally back into his chair. He stamped the clipboard under his lap, then held his hand out to Arthur. You have my word, he said. The slaves will go free, and they will be safe. I will halt my assassination attempts on you and Rabia.
You are trying to assassinate me and Rabia?
Arthur interrupted.
Don't be an idiot, Mr. McDowell. Of course I do.
As I was saying, the slaves will go free, and you will return to your job with only an infraction, of which I just stamped. This all goes away the moment Human Resources hears about my ambitions. Are we agreed? The work klaxon sounded like an anguished banshee chewing broken china. There was a hurried sound of feet outside. Soon it would be drowned out by the sound of gunfire. Boyd's hand hovered in front of Arthur. Agreed, Arthur said as he clasped Boyd's dry hand and shook it. What color paper stock should I write the orders for the slaves' continued safety on? Arthur swallowed a dry mouth. Boyd had somehow narrowed it down to a change of color. He briefly wondered if the operation clerk's face was still intact. Mahogany, he said. To Arthur's surprise, Boyd appeared to hold up on the deal, at least immediately. He turned to his left and opened a filing cabinet just enough to pull out a mahogany piece of paper. He wrote, All slaves are to be captured alive for collection. Repeat order on the hour. Then he handed the form and the write-up to Arthur. File this to the operator, would you? Once done, take the day off. I don't care what you do, just stay out of the way. Arthur took the form. Though 1,000 cynical voices in his head were ready to sound the alarm and be on the lookout, a louder part of him could not help but feel elated. Without machismo, without brute strength, and with only a single piece of paper, Arthur had defeated Henry S. Boyd. And he got to keep his job. Yes, this last point shouldn't matter. It was dumb, but he was still Arthur McDowell, pencil pusher and number cruncher extraordinaire. He could have gloated. He should have warned Boyd of the dangers of backstabbing him. But instead, Arthur took his forms and dutifully walked out of the van. He had won, but he had won on uncertain terms. As he walked out of the van, he was happy to discover that his spine was not permanently hunched from the van's low ceiling. He walked briskly to the operator's tent. He could only deliver the form, hold on his end of the truce, and hope that Boyd did the same. Out in the distance, he saw the tax army advance on the walls of Slaver City. He was at once grateful that he did not have to partake in the war that day, assuming that the war did not come to him, and cowardly for feeling grateful. The crack of exploding gunpowder and the bellowed screams of a man's last breath helped to ease that guilt, however. The morning sun had finally risen over the mountain. Whatever signs of rain existed on the other side of the mountain from the day before had vanished, and the only cloud in the sky worked its way slowly to never touch the sun. Nothing would obscure God's view of the atrocities that would occur today. They should have paid their taxes, Arthur thought to himself with an acrid mix of dread and dry humor. He hoped that his own would not be the only victory of the day. The tent and the towering loudspeakers were not far away. In just a few steps, he was inside the tent to find the same woman as the day before. No scratch or bruise on her. Maybe Boyd was not as bad as Arthur had thought, rampant psychopathy aside. He handed the form to the woman. She took it and relaxed her shoulders.
Finally, she said. You would think everyone around here suddenly forgot what a rainbow looked like.
They both laughed at this, neither seeming to think that a rainbow with mahogany red was an irrational expectation of nature. The operator read the form over the loudspeaker, her voice booming over their heads like a bored god. Arthur thanked her for her time and exited the tent. the slaves were safe. They would be collected as back taxes, just as Arthur had intended and hoped. As he exited the tent, he heard a ruckus of shouting and arguing nearby. Just across from him was one of the medical tents he had seen being built when he decided to confront Boyd the day before. He normally would have ignored it. After all, "not my problem" is a deeply ingrained instinct in every post-nuclear office worker. But there was something especially feral and very familiar with the shouting. In an instant, Rabia flew out of the tent shouting a string of dirty curses behind her at an unseen doctor. Arthur's heart sang at the sight of her. He was almost starstruck. But then, of course, he saw the details. She was dragging an IV drip still inserted in her arm behind her, and had a very large-looking harpoon gun over her shoulder. She was covered in dirt, ash, and cocaine? It was probably cocaine. This was Rabia. She looked tired, almost drunk. Her hair was nappy and her lips were cracked. She looked like she had just been through hell and stopped to see all of the attractions. "Rabia!" Arthur cried out to her and ran to close the horrible distance between them. Rabia's head spun right at Arthur's direction, and her rage was washed over by excitement. They embraced, despite the threat of becoming tangled in Rabia's IV bag, and kissed. Of all of the things that tried to fight to the surface of his mind, "I missed you. I love you. Are you okay? Why are you here?" "Only, you've got cocaine all over the lens of your sunglasses," triumphed. It was not the sort of romantic reuniting he imagined. "Is that why one eye is so blurry?" Rabia asked with honest astonishment. "This is exactly the kind of romantic moment I imagined," she continued, as the tense doctor rushed out. "You need to lay down," said the doctor, an older gentleman aged in liver spots on his head and a jowl that would make a dog envious.
"You need to let a goddamn professional woman do her patriotic duty, you hateful sawbones bastard," Rabia yelled as she affectionately touched Arthur's hip.
Her tone at once dropped to a rational level. "You're alive," she said as a smile graced her face. "She didn't get to you."
"What?
Who?" Arthur stammered.
"Dinner, the crazy hell larva you saved. Boyd hired her to assassinate you. I thought it was too late. I thought I failed."
"Of course Boyd hired a child to kill me," Arthur replied as the doctor pleaded in vain for Rabia to return to the tent. "What happened to you?"
"Later, long story, the brat is still out there hunting for you. I'm okay," she replied.
"You are not okay," the doctor yelled in desperation. Only Arthur made eye contact with him.
"Come on, I need to get something more rational to deal with dinner," Rabia said, nudging the harpoon gun behind her, then yanked the IV drip out of her arm with a flinch and let the hose fall to the ground.
"Just promise me you'll keep her hydrated," the doctor tried one last time. Arthur agreed to ease things over.
"I have a canteen back in our tent," Arthur said. Arthur grabbed Rabia's hand then, happy to find her squeeze his back affectionately. He led them back to his tent. He tried not to jump to conclusions. Had Boyd already gone back on his promise, or had he not yet had time to rescind the order to dinner to kill him? Was it better to hold up on his end of the deal in case it was the latter and not give Boyd a reason to break it? Or was it better to assume the worst? Arthur elected to at least go back to the tent and confer with Rabia. She would know what to do. She always knew how to handle the situation, even if her solutions were extreme enough that hyperbole fell flat. The journey to the tent held a companionable silence, broken only by well-founded paranoia and the sounds of violence in the distance. Arthur parted the opening to the tent. Inside, Arthur was happy to see that Richard and Ralph had returned. She was just so small that he did not notice her at first. Dinner stood just beneath him, a gun in her hand, and her finger on the trigger.
A Happy Bureaucracy by M.P. Fitzgerald. Narrated by Gary Bennett. Author's note: strewn between drug use, groin malice, and cursing on a level tantamount to sacrilege are gratuitous mentions of bureaucracy.
These bureaucratic references may not be for the weak of heart. Prologue. Stifled breath was held as an offense was made on the door. There was nothing here but dust and radiation, and the cold glare from an uncaring sun. There was supposed to be no one living for miles, he had made sure of that. Yet, blows rattled the door in quick succession. The word knocking was not in his vocabulary, because no one had knocked since the war. He did not dare let out his breath, but realized a fraction too late that she, the little girl with a knife to her throat, had begun to cry. Whoever was on the other side of the door would hear her. The option to hide had gone. Fuck, he whispered at the child. Her whimpers were not loud, but when silence is the natural order, even a sneeze from a mouse would sound like blaring klaxons. He put down the butcher's knife onto his table, and the little girl's eyes spelled relief. He replaced the knife with his rusty hunting rifle. Fight or flight were now having their familiar debate inside of him, and before either could win, another blow came at the door. Hello? A meek voice sent through the door. Do you have a moment? What is this? The man thought, uncertain if there was any danger. Instinct won over indecisiveness, and he loaded an ancient bullet into the gun's chamber. Hello? The little girl whimpered. Yes, hello. Do you have time to talk? The voice asked politely. It is very important. Slavers kick in the door. Raiders wait until you're outside. This was confusing. So, with the affront to his brain winning, and the option of surprise gone, the man opened the door. Outside, there was dust, and then there was irradiated dust. What was once a thriving and happy suburb, a perfect portrait of the American dream, was now a dead nightmare. The hydrogen bombs never made it this far, but their wrath spread without impetus. The war had ended modern history, and it started something that would make the Dark Ages look like a regular renaissance. The houses that were once built for families were now mostly empty, rotting slowly under a cruel sun. The grass that once grew on this house's lawn had dried up decades ago, and then burned for warmth. What were once windows were now a collection of boards nailed into the wall of the house haphazardly, their origin likely from the picket fences of the other houses, the people responsible for nailing them now long dead. What was outside was misery, misery, and dust. There should be nothing else. Yet, there he was, standing weaponless and awkwardly, was a man who was somehow washed and clean-shaven, his hair cut short and parted to the right, businesslike. His skin was somehow fair and not sun-damaged to a tan leather. This man, against all odds, was wearing clothes that had not only been washed, but also ironed. His shirt collared and white, his shoes black polished and neatly tied. There was something around his neck. It should have been the bones of his enemies, strung through their dried tendons. It should have been a makeshift bandolier made of bullets and spikes. But instead, it was a tie. A regular black tie, with a Windsor knot. Whether there should have been a club, a gun, or a spear in hand, was a clipboard and a pen. The pen was not stabbed into someone's eyes, which was the only use he had ever witnessed seeing someone do with one. He had only ever seen someone who looked like this in photographs, before the war. Standing in the distance, leaning on what was once a tree, was a man who did look like he belonged. Shotgun in hand, he was dressed in biker leathers, and as rugged and miserable as the earth beneath him. This was professional protection. After making eye contact, he lowered his weapon. No one needed to die yet. Hello, the man in the tie said. My name is Arthur McDowell. I am an agent of the Internal Revenue Services. And you are? What? The man responded. I am an agent for the IRS.
I am here for an audit.
He had been warned about this. Of all the gangs in the United Wastes, the IRS was the most powerful. He had never met an agent, but he had met others who had. The last time he had joined a raiding gang, the oldest of the group told him once that,
"There are only two for sure things in this world, death and taxes. The IRS wants only one of those, but they'll take both if you do not cooperate."
Everything else he had heard sounded like myth or a horror story. Arthur McDowell clicked the top of his pen tentatively, as dust from the dead planet beneath him shifted from wind. Arthur was now looking at the man inquisitively, and the man behind him in leather rested a single finger on his trigger.
"Is this the residence of the murder man?" Arthur asked.
Someone talked. Someone gave him away. If anybody in his old gang had sold him out to slavers, torture would come before death once he got his paws on them. But if the stories about the IRS were true, he wasn't sure if he could even be mad. Hell, if the stories were true, he'd do the same.
"Yeah, I'm Murder Man."
"Good," said Arthur, hurriedly writing something on his board. "Mr. Man, it seems that you did not do your taxes this season. Now, as the Postal Service has not delivered here in a generation, we can understand the oversight. As an auditor, I am here to fix that."
"Oh," said Murder Man. What are taxes?"
"That is a surprisingly common question, Mr. Man, so no need to be embarrassed."
He wasn't embarrassed at all. He was afraid.
"Taxes are a percentage of your income that is mandatorily volunteered to the United States government for the goods and services provided to you, a citizen, and to keep the government running. It is our patriotic duty and law to pay them."
"Oh.
It looks like you have not paid your taxes this season, Mr. Man, and though the IRS understands that this kind of omission is likely, given the circumstances," Arthur swept his hand around him, meaning circumstances to be human holocaust by nuclear fire, "they still must be paid."
The man in the biker leathers stood upright at "must be paid" and stepped a little closer. Murder Man had no intention of pissing him off.
How you want me to pay him?" Murder Man asked, not eloquently.
"With United States currency, of course."
"You want old world money?"
"Preferably, yes, but the IRS has positioned itself to work with today's economy, so for your convenience, we are willing to take bullets or calories."
This was the most polite raid Murder Man had ever experienced. Keeping his gun low so as to not piss off the hired help, Murder Man leaned on his doorframe, eyeing Arthur suspiciously. He was hoping the girl stayed quiet.
"How much you want?"
he finally asked, after another moment filled with listless dust passed.
"That is what we are here to find out, Mr. Man. I know that you are unfamiliar with our process. Again, nothing to be embarrassed about,"
Arthur said to a man who was still not embarrassed.
"We do not take a set amount from everybody. We only take a percentage of your combined income and assets."
Murder Man knew neither of those words, but it was the one that sounded more sexual that raised his interest.
"What's a ass set?" he asked.
"Oh, why, those are the things you own. Let's go through those first. You own this house?"
"Yeah."
"Good, good," Arthur said, writing on his clipboard. He seemed to be enjoying himself. "Let's see, you are a homeowner, and according to your old gang, you were a raider by profession?"
Someone did talk.
Murder Man's mind howled with rage. His words were muted.
"Yeah, I don't do that no more."
Arthur did not look up at this, and his writing quickened.
"Unemployed? That's a shame. Have you been jobless this whole season?"
Not sure what Arthur meant by season. Murder Man stared blankly and said,
"Yeah,"
just to hurry things along.
"It can be a very hostile job market in today's world, that is for sure. Well, judging by the size of your house and the fact that it is not radiated, we will classify it as Class 3. You should be very proud."
Thank you? Mm-hmm, Arthur replied, still laying his attention on the clipboard.
Assuming you can't pay with currency, that would put what you owe to be 80,000 calories, 150 bullets, or a combination of the two.
Arthur reached into his pocket and fished out a calculator.
I can, of course, help you with the conversion.
Murderman's breathing was thin. Flight or fight had not been resolved. I don't have that, he started, before he was quickly interrupted by a now giddy Arthur.
Wait, we haven't gone over your deductibles. The IRS is no armed robber, sir, he declared, despite having an armed man behind him. Do you have any dependents?
What's that? Before Arthur could answer, the little girl stirred. Murderman had no time to retaliate, and before he could make a move to hide her, she was peeking out of the doorway. Her dirty, bruised face that had only known fear and hunger looked out and onto Arthur's clean and studious one. It looked like children were not something Arthur saw often. They stared at each other with suspicion and disbelief. Arthur shifted his weight uneasily as his enforcer, the hired help, moved forward.
That, Arthur said, pointing at the little girl, is a dependent.
He made a little check on his board. Murderman thumbed back at the little girl, and his hanging jaw snapped back into place to speak. My cow? He asked.
My mistake, Arthur replied, sullenly, understanding the term. Sees your calories, he continued, stating, not asking.
Yeah, was gonna chop her and cook her before you punched my door all polite-like. A grin crept onto Murderman's face. The little girl had been taught not to run, and even now, in the face of death, she did not dare. She had been kept alive this long only so that her meat would be fresh when Murderman ran out of canned food.
Can't say for certain until we get her to the headquarters and weigh her, but she looks to be around 90,000 calories. This would leave you with a refund of 10,000 calories, which we'd mail to you within 4 to 5 weeks, Arthur said hurriedly, still avoiding eye contact.
He finished writing and presented the clipboard to Murderman.
Sign here.
Murderman did not understand the gesture, nor could he write or read. What he did understand, though, was that the men in front of him intended to rob him of his meal. A meal he had gone a great length to keep it alive this long, and one that was only going to be eaten if he had no other food. The IRS was as confusing and frightening as he had heard. The man in leather could certainly kill him, but if they took his food, well, he would die slowly. The math was simple. Starve or go out fighting. He cocked his gun.